No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So if you have a question, you can Skype it to us at bbsradio.com, or you can call in at 888-627-6008. And I'm so excited tonight that we have Brody Mullins. Brody is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and co-author of the book The Wolves of K Street, the secret history of how big money took over big government. He won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting for stories in the Wall Street Journal that exposed thousands of high-ranking government officials who own stocks in the companies they regulate. Amazing. Brody's going to tell you how to get the book. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's a must-read for everybody. I've been in politics for 40 years, and I've been troubled by the money that's involved ever since the day I started. So, Brody, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is awesome. I appreciate it.
Tell us about the book. Let's start there. Tell us the thesis of the book, or beyond the obvious title.
Yeah, so, I've been a reporter in Washington for 30 years covering industry and business. I'm also a native Washingtonian, so my whole life in D.C. And one of the things I did not know until recently, which is really the thesis of the book, is how powerful corporations and the corporate lobby is in Washington these days. We basically write about how the corporate lobby at times is as powerful, if not more powerful, than with the President of the United States and members of Congress at times. And we sort of write about, one, how the corporate lobby got so powerful, two, how the corporate lobby is bending legislation to help corporations, help corporate executives, and to basically, hurt regular Americans. And then three, we sort of write about how lobbying tactics have changed and how lobbyists have gotten more powerful by using tactics that really bring along members of Congress to their side.
And has the environment changed for them? You know, I hear people all the time when they, for example, support people like Donald Trump, who's a businessman, they say, well, government should run like a business, which is, to me, ridiculous, because if that were the truth, you wouldn't need government. But has the environment become easier for them? Do we believe that corporations are going to take care of us in the future?
Yeah, I think the environment has gotten a lot easier for companies, in part because they're no longer battling in the lobbying world major opponents. As in, in the last 100 years, almost 100 years, labor unions and consumer groups have had lots of influence in Washington, have basically put up a fair fight against corporate lobbyists. So corporations and their lobbyists have fought to create pro-business and pro-industry positions and policies in Washington, but labor unions and consumer groups, the Ralph Naders of the world, have sort of fought them for many years, actually defeated them, were stronger than them. But in the last 30 years, the Ralph Naders of the world, the consumer groups are not as influential as they used to be. Labor unions, as we know, barely exist in terms of influence in Washington. So right now, companies are the only game in town, and members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, often find themselves doing things that corporate America wants that regular Americans don't want.
Yeah, you know, as a former Teamster, I started out, one of my first decent jobs was as a Teamster. And I can tell you, back then, when the Teamsters talked, everybody listened. I don't know that that's true anymore. They were also solidly on one side, which they no longer are. You know, many of the working class people that we had as Democrats have, we no longer have. In fact, we've lost him to a guy that's a billionaire, which is really kind of confusing, but that's happened. So let me ask you today, here's the big story today. Front page of the Washington Post, leading story. This is what, this is how it starts. Hours after the Supreme Court sharply curbed the power of federal agencies, conservatives and corporate lobbyists began planning how to harness the favorable ruling in a redoubled quest to whittle down climate, finance, health, labor, and technology regulations in Washington. Is that as scary as it sounds?
Yeah, well, so, you know, the way things have always worked in Washington in my lifetime is that Congress makes the law. Congress passes laws and sort of leaves the details of the implementation to federal agencies and to what I consider, I think most people consider, you know, the experts on policy, which are federal agencies and bureaucrats. What this Supreme Court decision said was that's not how things are going to work in the future, that Congress needs to create the law and then explain explicitly how the law is going to be implemented, and that federal agencies can only follow explicitly what Congress says. What that means is that Congress and instead of the agencies are going to have really much more authority over the details of implementing incredibly complex laws. The problem there is that Congress is heavily influenced by corporate lobbyists. Corporate lobbyists are, have a very strong hand in Congress, not as much among agencies, which means that Congress, that, that corporate, the corporate lobby, the industry will have a far stronger role in important industry regulations going forward than they had in the last, you know, 50, 100 years.
Well, and imagine if you're a congressman, right? You ran a chain of shoe stores, became a millionaire, ran for Congress, and you got elected. And all of a sudden you're sitting on the transportation committee trying to decide about complex transportation issues. What do you know about those issues, right?
Right.
I mean, it seems like they're putting the cart before the horse here. I think that's very, very dangerous.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that the members of Congress are generalists. They sort of have a general idea about big policy issues, and they're sort of legislating and regulating at the 45,000-foot level, and it's up to agency experts. I mean, the government is set up so the experts in policy who have worked on agency issues for or industry issues for 30 or 40 years, you know, those types of people are at agencies, and they're interpreting what Congress wants and implementing sort of the will of Congress, what they think the will of Congress is. This is reversing that whole process and saying that members of Congress who are generalists need to all of a sudden become the experts. And I think that's going to be very hard for them to do.
Yeah, it's going to be very hard for them to do. And, you know, since when I started in politics, we used to have, and it's funny, it, as a Washingtonian, maybe you know about this place, but there used to be a club around the corner from where I worked, which had no windows. All the windows were blacked out, and it was a place where the lobbyists took politicians for what were renowned to be fabulous lunches and stuff. Since we can't do that anymore, you can't give a congressman anything of value worth more than $50. That's true of the Senate, too. Is this all about campaign contributions? Is that where the money comes in? Is that what?
I think that's part of it. I think that's, you know, the corporate lobby has a very strong hand, has a lot of influence on Capitol Hill with members of Congress. And that's because members of Congress need to run for re-election. You know, the number one thing a member of Congress wants to do is get re-elected. In order to get re-elected, you need 51% of your constituents. And in order to do that, you need money. You need money to run campaigns, you know, as you know, and run ads, which are incredibly expensive. Yes. And that means that members of Congress, lots of members of Congress, you know, want to do what corporate America wants because they need their money to run for Congress. Agencies are separate. You know, people who work at federal agencies, you know, there's tens of thousands of them, don't run for Congress. They have, you know, basically tenured jobs. Many of them are members of public labor unions, and they're going to have their jobs forever. And therefore, they're doing what they believe is in the best interest of their of the country, and what you know, they're carrying out policies they think are right. They're much more immune from the corporate lobby. So this Supreme Court decision is going to give the people, the lawmakers who are subject to or heavily influenced by lobbyists, give them much more power over legislation and remove the people, the agency officials who are immune from the corporate lobby from that process. And that seems sort of backwards to me.
Well, one of the things that's always annoyed me about Republicans, and don't get me started because there's a lot of things that annoy me about Republicans, is them saying that you know, it's your money. The government should give it back to you. We should spend our tax money at the local level instead of the federal, allowing the federal government to spend it. And the truth of the matter is, it's a lot easier to corrupt people at the local level than it is at the federal level, just for what you said. There's so many more people involved in the federal level. You know, you can't give your cousin a paving contract right through the federal government. And so,
there's also a lot more scrutiny. I think a lot more scrutiny of the members of Congress. I mean, when I was a reporter on Capitol Hill, every reporter on Capitol Hill is looking to write a story about Senator so-and-so or Representative, you know, X doing a favor for their top lobbyists or one of their top friends or former staffer. So therefore, members of Congress don't want to do those things because they don't want stories, you know, written in Politico or Punch Bowl or Roll Call, where I used to work. So there's a lot more scrutiny about what members of Congress do, which sort of can keep members of Congress closer to the straight and narrow. Whereas exactly what you say at the local level, you know, there's just so little oversight what's going on down there.
Well, and let me ask you, we had a couple of weeks ago, I had a guy named Ari Berman who reports for the New York Times, and he was saying that he's worried about reporters and media outlets because they need to newspapers to stay alive. They need advertisers, and he thinks that we're going to see more and more, especially as these things get consolidated and smaller, we're going to see corporate influence more in the press. Do you think that's going to happen? Do we have to, because that's what we rely on, right, for our information,
yeah,
the free press.
You know, there's no doubt that the media is under fire, that you know, the regional newspapers that used to be thriving and used to have reporters in Washington covering their local delegations, those regional newspapers are much less influential. They have far fewer reporters. They usually only have one or so reporter in Washington, maybe two, who are so busy covering what the president's doing or what Congress is voting on, there's no time left over for looking into members of Congress, seeing what they're doing or trying to expose corporate activity. I mean, think about this. You know, the Washington Post is probably three or maybe four major national newspapers in existence today. And one of them is the Washington Post. And the Washington Post obviously covers Washington. And you know what the Washington Post doesn't cover? Lobbying. The Washington Post does not have a reporter who covers the lobbying and influence business, which, in my opinion, is our hometown industry. I mean, everyone in Washington who's not a member of Congress or doesn't work in a school or at a university or in a restaurant is involved in the influence business, shaping and trying to craft rules on behalf of corporations or other interest groups. You know, it seems like the Washington Post should be covering that industry, and they don't. Yeah. And my point is that if the Washington Post is not covering corporate influence in Washington, then no one is, and that's really the case.
Well, and you know, to talk about small and regional newspapers too, you probably know that we've had several local politicians that have left office because of malfeasance, and every story about them started in the city paper, which is a little tiny newspaper, right? None of them started in the Washington Post. Several times the Washington Post picked up the story, but they all started in this little newspaper, which is from my understanding, suffering right now, along with so many others. But so that's really important. What about federal funding of elections? We have a current system, but that doesn't seem to be doing anything. Should we outlaw fundraising for politicians and say, if you're running for federal office, if you're going to be a member of Congress, you get government money and that's it?
Yeah, so that's a great topic. I mean, in covering Washington for 25 or 30 years, I can tell you, with 100% certainty, if you remove money from politics, we're going to have a better government that's going to better serve the people. The problem is that I think that's impossible to do. Campaign donations and political contributions are a protected form of speech under the First Amendment. In fact, even lobbying, as much as people complain about lobbying, the right to petition one's government is also protected by the First Amendment. There have been bills in the past to have a publicly financed elections or presidential elections or congressional elections. I think that if you were to figure out a way to do that, it certainly could make the system better. But, we've been talking about trying to create a publicly financed election system for decades, and nothing has happened. So if there's a way to snap your fingers and remove money from politics, government will be better. I think it's just very hard to figure out how to do that.
Yeah, it is very hard. And you know what? We have more time on the fundraising end to figure out ways around it. When I worked at the DNC, I was in charge of complying with the FEC. And I can't tell you how many ways we found getting around FEC regulations. You're only allowed to give a maximum of $50,000 a year. And we found ways to take millions of dollars from people, put it into what we call non-federal money and things like that. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, it's a fascinating topic. At the same time, though, I think, one of the things we write about in our book, The Wolves of K Street, is that every time that reformers have sort of a well-intentioned idea of a way to fix the system, lobbyists or big corporate donors figure out a way around the system.
Yeah.
And a really good example is the McCain-Feingold reforms of 2002, which, the great idea there was, at the time, companies were donating, as you said, millions of dollars to the DNC and to the RNC, and the McCain-Feingold bill, which was bipartisan, stopped that. And it said that big companies, that labor unions, and that individuals cannot give unlimited donations to the political parties. And all that sounded like a great idea. But now, 20 years later, what that's led to is these super PACs and billionaires and outside campaign groups are allowed to accept million-dollar donations from billionaires and individuals and labor unions and corporations, but the political parties are not. So what that has created is that the political parties are no longer have the authority or strength that they used to, and that in elections, in U.S. elections these days, the political parties have very little voice. They can't raise as much money as these outside groups. So today, the fact is that billionaires have far more influence and control over U.S. elections than the political parties, and sometimes even the candidates. I mean, the candidates today have less control over their own elections than super PACs and billionaires and political parties, and that's really a problem, I think.
Well, why don't we get this as well on the federal level as we do on the local level? I've testified before the House in New Hampshire and just recently the Senate in Nebraska. And in New Hampshire, lobbyists that are in the Capitol building have to wear this tag that looks like a damn license plate. I mean, it's gigantic around their neck, right? That says lobbyists. And in Nebraska, they won't let them into the Senate. They have to gather outside. It's when you're walking in to testify, it's like you're going into the Academy Awards. There's lobbyists everywhere. And, and when they come out, that's their only chance to talk. Supposedly, is to buttonhole these people as they come out. But I think most of those people are not corporate lobbyists. I think the corporate lobbyists, know how to get a hold of you. They don't need to buttonhole you on the way to the floor.
I spend a lot of time in the U.S. Senate, off the Senate floor, and if you go up there by the elevators on the second floor where members of Congress or senators, come from their Senate offices and go on the floor, I mean, there's lots of lobbyists there. There's lots of reporters there also. But you're right. I mean, I think there are lobbyists have other ways of getting to members of Congress. They obviously spend lots of time on fundraising events where they're able to talk to lawmakers and senators about policy. But almost every lobbyist I see up there is a lobbyist for a corporation, not a lobbyist for an environmental group or for certainly not for citizens.
There's a rule that once the president has a nomination once Trump actually secures a nomination at the convention, or Biden does, then the campaigns can no longer raise money. All the money has to be raised through the DNC or the RNC. At least that's the way it was when I was there. I assume it's still true. Is that, you think that's any kind of a solution to say, you can still raise money, but it's got to come through the political party and not directly to the candidate?
I'm not sure if that would solve things. I mean, and you're talking about just the presidential.
No, right? I'm talking about, could we expand that to all candidates? If you're going to be, once you get the party's nomination, you can only run, you can only get money through the party.
Yeah, you know, that's not a bad idea. But, you know, as you know, House members are running for election constantly. Right. And the, you know, once they get the nomination, it's very late in the process. I mean, one of the ways that members of Congress or House members and senators stay in office is they try to raise so much money so early so that people are thinking of running against them, see, you know, how much money they've already raised from companies and don't enter the race. So I think what you're saying is it might be a good step forward. But I think, companies and will try to just give the money to their favorite candidates well before that deadline.
Yeah, that's probably true. And you know, I think personally that if you wanted to improve the quality of Congress, the House, you would give people 4-year terms instead of 2-year terms. Because these guys start raising money the week after the election.
They have to raise some money,
right, for the reelection, and they have to. And as somebody that's run for election many times, even only citywide, believe me, somebody that gives you $50,000, when he calls you, you will answer the phone. I mean, yeah, anybody that thinks that money's not, you know, is not the corrupter that it really is crazy.
That's the problem, is that you know who your friends are, and, you know, members that corporate lobbyists and corporations have the money. Members of Congress need that money to run for re-election because of the cost of television ads and whatnot. And they're going to be, as you say, they're going to take the call or take the meeting with someone who's given them a lot of money. And that, what we write about in our book is that gives companies an unfair advantage, that when the president of some company or the lobbyist of some company calls a member of Congress for a meeting, and then a regular citizen calls for a meeting, you know, the companies have the advantage. They're going to get the meeting because they're raising money for the lawmaker, and regular citizens are not.
Well, you know, I just can't imagine that in your bio, when we introduced you, you said you uncovered the fact that many members of Congress have shares in the companies they regulate. I know in Washington, D.C., we had the chairman of the city council owned a couple of shares in Pepco, which is our local, electricity supplier, and people went nuts. They said he had to divest himself. So why don't we do that at the federal level? How can you own AT&T stock and then regulate AT&T? I don't get it.
Yeah.
Why isn't that a conflict of interest?
It is a conflict of interest. What we looked at is we looked at federal agencies. We looked at 50 federal agencies and senior members of those agencies. You know, hundreds of people at top federal agencies need to file a financial disclosure form each year, which says, what stocks that they are invested in. And believe me, when we gathered these forms and started looking at them, I thought, you know, there's no way in hell that someone at the Food and Drug Administration is going to own stock in pharmaceutical and drug companies. And there's no way that people at the Federal Trade Commission, whose job it is to look into and regulate Facebook and Google and these big tech companies, there's no way they're going to own stock in Google and Facebook and Amazon. And we looked at these forms and they did. You know, I mean, not everyone, but I think the number we had was 1 out of 5, you know, almost 20% of top federal officials, top agency officials own stock in companies that their agencies regulated. And it was almost sad to see, because it just shouldn't be that way.
Well, you know, I had to do that, and I have no vote in Congress, and I still had to do it. Nobody's trying to bribe me. I got no corporate lobbyists coming after me, you know, and I still had to do it. You know, one of my great ideas that never panned out was I had a favorite show called Veep, where the president had two dummies that worked for her, and I always thought that corporate lobbyists should bribe the senators from D.C. to vote on an issue because they didn't understand we didn't have a vote. But they didn't go for it. But anyway, it's true. I mean, I had to fill out an application of every stock I owned in my 401k, and you know, and I don't get to decide on any of this stuff. So it's crazy that there's so much of that goes on, I think. But can you explain to us, without getting too technical about it, because I'm not sure that I fully understand this, what the Chevron decision was and how that was the thing that the court overturned, which is leading to all this other stuff, or potentially?
So this is a complicated case, but the way I understand it is that Chevron sued the executive branch in a case that went to the Supreme Court over whether an agency had the right to, or the ability to, or the jurisdiction and the authority to implement a regulation that Congress had enacted. So Congress enacted the law, and like I said earlier, Congress in general says, you know, it's illegal to do X or Y, but the agency sort of creates the actual rules and regulations to implement that law. In this case, Chevron thought that the agency went too far, and the agency did something that Congress did not intend, because Congress didn't explicitly say Congress didn't say exactly how the regulation should be written. And so Chevron sued and said the agency had gone too far. The Supreme Court agreed with Chevron. And what that means going forward is that agencies will not be able to go too far in interpreting what Congress meant in certain regulations. And therefore, that's really going to mean that agencies are hamstrung. They'll not have the authority to create new rules and regulations based off of what Congress has passed. And in fact, it'll be up to Congress to say how far regulation should go. So what it'll mean in effect is that it really hamstrings the influence or the ability of federal agencies to create rules and regulations affecting industry. So it's a huge win for industry and a big loss for government regulators and federal agencies.
Yeah, and when I was in graduate school, they taught us that that's the way it was supposed to work. That the agencies were supposed to work out the details. You know, that's correct. Why we always said the devil's in the details, right?
Correct.
The legislation can say whatever it wants, but it's how it's all worked out. But exactly. Let me ask you, have we created an environment, back to the whole environment question, one of the things in the Post article, they say some of this is because federal agencies have taken more of an active role in crafting policy. Have we overreached?
That's what the Supreme Court is saying in this case. Yeah. And obviously that's the big, you know, for the last 50 years, you know, one of the battles we've had between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party is that Republicans think that these unelected federal bureaucrats and agencies are going too far in creating rules and regulations that affect industry, and that what they should be doing is only should be limited by what Congress says in the law. And the Democrats have said, well, no, that's not true. What these agencies are trying to do is simply to implement, as you say, you know, carry out the wishes of what Congress intended. So that's sort of the tension we have right here. And the Supreme Court for the first time has weighed in on the side of conservatives and saying that these agencies have gone too far. I think, you know, there'll be a lot more to be said here. This is not the end of this fight. I think, you know, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of regulations that now could be up for judicial review as a result of this. I think companies across the board, and I think this is what this Washington Post story was saying, is companies and industries across the board are going to say, well, what regulations are there out there now that we don't like, that we can use this Supreme Court decision to go out and attack. And that's really where the rubber is going to meet the road.
Well, and we, the scary thing again, is that these, we don't know what's going to happen exactly, but this makes it easier for court challenges. Right. And we expect they're going to challenge environmental protections and
everything.
Yeah, especially, you know, and that's one of the things I love, environmental protections. Like, they don't understand that California's on fire and Florida's underwater and, you know, and we really need to do something about the environment. They want to roll things back and drill, baby, drill.
I mean, any sort of consumer regulation, environmental regulations are a great one, civil rights regulation. I mean, if you're an industry and you feel that there's a regulation that you don't like, and there's, you know, every company in the country has regulations they don't like, you might as well file a court challenge and cite this Supreme Court case and see if you can get overturned. Can't hurt.
Right.
And you might win on lots of them.
Well, we've talked more than half the show about how scary all this is. Is there anything we can do to mitigate this stuff beyond, you know, getting a few new expanding the Supreme Court and putting some non-conservatives on it? Is there anything we can do?
So most of our book is about the rise of corporate power and corporate influence in Washington, something that, you know, we can talk about the history of that, but something that started in the 1970s and now companies are incredibly influential. But my brother Luke and I started writing this book in 2017, and last year when we were wrapping up the book, we realized, you know, companies are actually not as influential as they were 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And that, in fact, it seems like consumers, Americans, like progressive Democrats and populist Republicans, are all of a sudden starting to come out more strongly against corporate America, and that the influence of corporations in the last few years is actually a little bit on the decline. And if you're looking for a silver lining, you know, it's possible that progressive Democrats and populist Republicans could team up on some legislation that hurts corporate America. And in fact, you know, we've seen that more and more in the last few years. And I can give you a couple of examples. Josh Hawley, who's a very conservative Republican from Missouri, has teamed up with Elizabeth Warner on a whole bunch of issues that would help companies, help consumers and hurt companies. They have a bill that would cap credit card fees. They have a bill that would make it easier for workers to join labor unions. And they have a bill that would cap or block CEOs of big banks from getting bonuses if their banks fail. You know, those are all really interesting proposals that are normally things that come from liberal Democrats. And having a Republican on those just sort of shows that the Republican Party is starting to change, and they're becoming a little bit more populist and a little bit more pro-worker. So if you're looking for a silver lining, you know, that could be it. Let me give you another example. For my entire life, the Republican Party has stood for four major things: less regulation, lower taxes, liberal immigration, as in letting more workers into the country, and free trade. And that's what the Republican Party stood for in the 50 years of my life. But all of a sudden, that's changing also. The Republican Party is now against trade, which is a huge business priority. They're against immigration, which is a huge business priority. They're still for lower taxes and less regulation, but they're starting to change more and more. Some Republicans, Marco Rubio is a good example in Florida, are for workers joining unions. And I feel like that's a little bit of a counteraction, or as a result of how much influence corporations and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce have had in Washington, that now some of these Republicans are fighting against, lashing out against U.S. companies, which is where Democrats are. So if those two sides, the far right and the far left, can get together, which increasingly they have, you know, that could make for a sort of pro-consumer, pro-worker movement in Washington for the first time in 50 years.
Well, dare to dream. It's hard to see it happening on Capitol Hill these days. But let me ask you, isn't there a bigger danger now that we see that Amazon and Walmart are on their way to taking over the whole world? I mean, right? We're losing small business, just like we're losing small newspapers, we're losing small businesses, right? And these guys are consolidating their power. Do they become the fourth estate all of a sudden? Do they become
what Republicans are saying, though, is that you know, I spoke for our book to J.D. Vance, who's a very conservative pro-Trump Republican senator from Ohio. Mm-hmm. And what he told me is that he believes that concentrated economic power, as in big businesses, are as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than concentrated government power, which is obviously the federal government. And, you know, that's a stunning thing for a Republican to say. But there's probably five or six Senate Republicans who believe the same thing. And these Republicans are looking at those very companies you mentioned, looking at Amazon and looking at Walmart and looking at Google and looking at Facebook and saying these companies, and looking at the big banks, you know, and saying these big companies have too much influence in our society and in our economy. And they are lashing out against those companies. And that's the silver lining that I think I mentioned a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, do federal agencies, given this recent ruling and the way things are going, federal agencies now, are they more reticent to regulate? Are they going to take this into consideration and not come down on, you know, the way they might on illegal polluters and other people because they're afraid that their decisions will be challenged and overturned? Do you think that's going to affect them?
I would think they would have to, right? If you're the head of a federal agency and you see the Supreme Court just said, you know, don't go too far or we'll slap you down. You know, I mean, these regulators, you know, if you're a regulator and you're a Democrat, you know, you want to regulate and that's your job. But if you see that you could lose in court and be embarrassed, then you're going to think twice. And just that, you know, thinking twice is going to stop lots of regulations. I'm sure there's tons of regulations that were in the works where agency officials are going to say, hey, are we going too far here? And so I think that's going to lead exactly to what you just said.
Well, and you know, only the government in most cases can take the long view. You know, I was in business for myself for 25 years and I had above my desk, a quote from a famous economist that said, in the long run, we are all dead. And that's the way small businessmen, that's how we think about it, right? We don't think about what's going to happen next year. We think about making the next payroll period and the next. So, you know, while like I say, California's on fire and Florida's flooding, we might say, well, you know, energy independence is important. We need more fossil fuel. And that seems to be what's going on now. And so, that's the scariest thing to me. Let me ask you, what do you think if we elect Donald Trump, if we reelect Donald Trump, is that the perfect storm? Then do the lobbyists have control of Congress and he has, you know, I mean, and he has control of the Supreme Court and him are teamed up? I mean, what do we do?
Look, let me try to stay a little optimistic here because, you know, the scenario you laid out, it certainly could be the case. But, you know, what I see is that the Republican Party, including Donald Trump, being a little more populist than they were a few years ago and 5 years ago. I mean, Donald Trump is the first Republican president in my lifetime who has attacked corporate America. Now, he did sign into law the huge $1.3 trillion tax cut for corporations, but he also, you know, bashed Boeing for building an Air Force One that was too expensive. He bashed other U.S. companies for moving jobs overseas. He's bashed Amazon. I mean, he's one of the few Republicans who's gone after big businesses. And since he left the White House, more and more Republicans are picking up that line and doing the same thing. You know, I mentioned J.D. Vance. I mentioned Josh Hawley. There's also Marco Rubio in Florida who has come out in favor of unionizing Amazon, you know, which is an amazing thing for a Republican to do. I'll give you another great example. You know, antitrust is a really good area to watch out for because, you know, the antitrust laws in the U.S. are the major tool that the federal government has to rein in the excesses and the size and influence of big businesses. And there's more and more Republicans who think that that the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Department should be taking a more aggressive stance on antitrust. There's a merger going on right now, Kroger's and Albertsons, two big grocery stores, where there's a number of Republicans, including Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, who are opposed to that merger and saying that the FTC should block that merger. There was a bill in Congress a year and a half ago that became law that increased taxes on or fees that big U.S. companies paid when they tried to merge. So when two companies tried to merge, they have to pay a fee. That money goes to help the Federal Trade Commission and the Antitrust Department hire more lawyers to review mergers. So basically, this is a bill that would take money from companies, give it to the U.S. government to try to block mergers. That bill was supported by 39 House Republicans. I mean, that is something that has never happened in my lifetime. And the point here is that I see more and more Republicans, including Donald Trump, who are more populist and more wary of the influence of big businesses. So even though you say, well, if Trump wins, like, it could be the perfect storm, it might be, but he's not as friendly to corporate America as a normal conservative Republican would be.
Well, from your lips to God's ear, I hope that's the truth.
I could be wrong. I feel like I see a movement where the country has changed. Also, that a lot of big U.S. companies no longer based in the Midwest and in rural areas; they're all on the East Coast in Democratic areas. Right. And there's a lot of Republicans who don't represent areas where there are big companies anymore, and therefore they're not as reflexively supportive of big companies. I mean, look at the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Jason Smith. He's from a rural part of Missouri. He's the guy whose job it is to write tax legislation. His job is to renew this corporate tax cut that's going to expire next year, the Trump tax cut. He's in an open warfare right now with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He has launched an investigation essentially into the tax status of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. U.S. Chamber of Commerce is big business. They represent big business. For my entire lifetime, the Chamber of Commerce and the Republican Party have been in lockstep. And now all of a sudden, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee is attacking the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I mean, it's, there's something happening out there.
Well, you make a lot of good points. No wonder you won a Pulitzer Prize. and I hope all that's true.
To be clear, this is a sliver of the Republican Party. This isn't all of the Republican Party. And the key is, what I'm trying to figure out is this 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 Republicans who are off the reservation, or is this a movement? And that's what I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's how movements start, right? With a few people off the reservation. And,
right.
And, I think that some of the issues that you talk about, like immigration and for the Republican Party, the reason they've moved away from those things is because fear sells in politics, unfortunately. That's the oldest tool, right? That's the oldest tool that politicians have is, you may think you're doing bad, but if you elect that other guy, you're going to do worse.
Right.
But that speaks to the last point you made, which is the environment is really important to the way these guys move, especially in the long term. So let's hope all that's true, because I'd love to see that. And, when I covered my first hearings, the first hearings I covered in graduate school were the breakup of the phone company. And AT&T would walk in with witnesses, and they would introduce them like this. They would say, "This is John Jones. You might remember him. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry at Bell Labs for so-and-so-and-so. This is Brody Mullins. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. This is Joe Blow. He won the Nobel Prize for, And then the Sierra Club would come along with a guy, a nice lawyer with patches on his elbows, who had been of his sport coat, and he would have been out of Columbia for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you would say to yourself, this isn't even competition. These guys, who are these guys going to listen to? These experts who are acclaimed, or the consumer people who are probably standing up for the right cause. But it was an amazing. If anybody wants to see how that corporate thing works, and I don't know if you guys looked at this, but it was an amazing thing to watch these corporate lobbyists actually lead Congress exactly down the road they want them to go. And the whole time they were talking about not breaking up the phone company, how horrible that would be, but they were providing them with information that would allow them to break up the phone company, which is exactly what they wanted because they made more money. Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, you're exactly right. And that's actually one of the main things we write about in the book, The Wolves of K Street, which is that, you know, the founding fathers foresaw that laws and regulations were not going to be made in a vacuum, that interest groups and lobbyists, you know, would be trying to shape rules and regulations. And in fact, they call them not lobbyists or interest groups, but factions. The founding fathers saw there'd be several sets of factions. There'd be a pro-industry faction, and there'd be a pro-worker faction, and maybe some others. And those two factions would be of equal size. They would battle each other to shape laws and regulation. And you sort of come up with an equilibrium that was, you know, something that, you know, companies would get a little bit of what they wanted, and interest and consumers would get a little bit of what they wanted. It'd be a fair compromise. Fast forward 200 years to now, you know, what we have is that there's really only one faction, as it's basically what you just said. There's the, you know, corporations that have so much money that they're hiring. They can afford to hire all the best lawyers and all the best minds. And, you know, they're outspending their opponents by 100-1. And that the Sierra Club or the consumer groups or whatever, you know, they have the lawyer right out of college who's, you know, trying to battle them, you know, push back on the corporate lobby, but just doesn't have the influence or the resources or the know-how or the experience. So that, you know, companies just have not their thumb on the scale, but have their whole foot on the scale. And consumer groups and the rest of us just don't, we don't have the influence to battle that. And that's really the problem.
Yeah, I'm all for the big license plate around their necks that says lobbyists. I mean, it's so funny. It's like one step away from putting them in stocks in front of the building, you know, chaining them up. But, and I think it's a great idea. It points them out to people for who they are. But then again, New Hampshire has a legislature that's only one person smaller than the federal government. It's they've got 435 representatives in 434 representatives in the government in the House in New Hampshire. So it's like everybody. I think there's only about 300 more people in the whole damn state. But now I'm going to get calls from people from New Hampshire. But I haven't seen the end of it so much that you've seen, other than the AT&T stuff that I followed. But I certainly have seen the influence that money has in politics and what we tried to do. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let's go back to AT&T, though. So, you know, there were a bunch of big antitrust cases in this country in the last century. But the last big one was AT&T and the baby bells that, you know, you were watching and involved with, where DOJ took on AT&T and called them a monopoly and broke them up. Between then and now, and that was the 1980s, and now, there's been nothing, like no big antitrust cases, as all these enormous companies have merged and merged and merged again. But now, for the first time, you have two DOJ antitrust investigations against Google. You've got a big one coming out of the Federal Trade Commission into Amazon. You know, we don't know if these cases are going to be successful, but the government for the first time is going after them. And what's most fascinating to me is that some of those Google cases and some of the Facebook cases began in the Trump administration. And this is kind of going back to my point. You know, even in the Trump administration, I think they were increasingly populist and anti-corporate back then, so that they started some of these cases that now Biden is continuing. So in a normal world, and this is not a normal world, corporate America would say, well, let's just elect a Republican president and everything will go back to normal and we'll be fine. But if they elect Donald Trump, I mean, his DOJ brought some of these Google lawsuits. So I don't know if electing Trump is going to solve things for corporate America on the antitrust front. It could just be that things are continuing, that both Republicans and Democrats think that some of these companies have just gotten too damn big and have too much influence.
And you think that's coming from outside pressure, from consumers to actually do that, from individual consumers?
Yeah, I think that Americans, doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, believe that these tech companies have too much influence in our lives, and that they are pressuring their members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, to take action. I went to a Federalist Society conference last November. The Federalist Society, of course, is a hugely conservative judicial advocacy group, basically like a wing of the Republican Party pushing for conservative judges. And they had a session with Lina Khan. Lina Khan is a big liberal regulator who runs the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, she is corporate America's nightmare right now. And at this Federalist Society group, this is the far right, hosting the far left, people there agreed. They agreed that that big tech companies have too much influence over Americans' lives. They came at it from completely different reasons. The Republicans at the conservatives at the Federalist Society conference were saying that that tech companies were stifling free speech and were not allowing people, conservatives, to spread their opinions on blogs and on Facebook. And Democrats just thought the companies were too big. But either way, they agreed that these companies are too big and have too much influence, and that the federal government should do something to rein them in. And that's, that was pretty stunning to me to see a big conservative judicial organization agreeing with Lina Khan.
Yeah. That's true. And, I got to tell you, I think it's all going to get worse with AI, too, which is on the side of corporations. I mean, my Alexa now says, "Good morning, Mike." It's scary as hell. he goes, "Good morning, Mike." It's like something out of 2001, A Space Odyssey. But look, you're just a fascinating guest. You know so much about this issue, and there's so much to talk about in the future. I hope as these things develop, we can have you back on the show. But we're running out of time here. I want to ask you two things. One, how we get your book. How do we get your book? Definitely. It's available at all bookstores?
Definitely. Yeah, available anywhere. If you're in D.C., Politics and Prose, or the bookstores up on Capitol Hill, Barnes & Noble. You can also get it on Amazon. It's out there anywhere you want to get it. So thank you.
And is there a question that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you, something you want to add?
One thing I find super interesting that I didn't know about until I started researching this book is that this era right now where corporations are incredibly influential is really just an era. It has not been this way forever. So when the country was founded, we didn't have industry at all. And it wasn't until after the Civil War and when the Industrial Age started that companies started to get some influence in Washington and in the country. And then those companies, many of them, became huge monopolies. You remember Standard Oil and J.P. Morgan, and the railroad industries became huge monopolies. But in the early 20th century, we created the Federal Trade Commission. We created antitrust law, and those companies were really reined in. And from that period to the 1970s, from the New Deal to the Great Society, companies actually had very little influence in Washington. And during that time, the federal government grew and grew and grew and grew, as we know, to sort of create the modern federal bureaucracy. And it was not until the 1970s that companies really started to gain influence again. Companies in the 1970s, the economy cratered with stagflation and inflation, and companies saw their profits go away, and they started for the first time investing in lobbyists and campaign donations to push back on the federal government. So the point is that we haven't always lived in this era of extreme corporate power. It just started in the 1970s, and the point there is just that this is not how things have to be and how things have always been, that this could just be a period. There could be a time when consumer groups or environmental groups or where citizens gain more power in the government than they have right now. So there could be a silver lining.
Well, and that's a great place to end the show. And thank you so much for what you do, because you really are the bulwark between us and the corporations, right? People in the free press and people that keep an eye on this. So thank God for what you're doing. Thank you so much. And congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize. And let me say that it's an honor to represent people like you. It's one of the best thing about being elected in Washington. And we give a song. We always leave the show with a song, and we dedicate it to our guest. And I couldn't think of any other song to play tonight except Pink, What About Us? So this is a great song, right? And you're a great guy. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. This is great. I appreciate it.
Yeah. We'll see you next week, folks.
We stood up and made the tough choices that needed to be made to preserve our way of life.
Give the people their right to vote.